Looks like everyone's connected, Angie, so whenever you're ready.
Okay, well, good evening. I'm Angie Smith, a local transportation advocate and currently serving on the Iowa City Climate Action Commission. I want to welcome you all to tonight's discussion being held in collaboration with the city's Climate Action Division and Office of Equity and Human Rights. Tonight's conversation is in honor of National Transit Equity Day, which is held on the birthday of Rosa Parks, whose refusal to sit in the back of a Montgomery, Alabama bus in 1955 helped spark a vital moment in the country's civil rights movement. We are so excited about tonight's discussion with author Veronica O. Davis. Just a little housekeeping before we get started. This call will be recorded so that we can share it with others who are unable to attend this evening. When you joined, you were automatically muted for the audio quality, but at the end of the discussion, we will have time for audience Q&A. So if you have any questions, you can raise your virtual hand or type in the Q&A box that will be up for the duration of the discussion. Megan from the Climate Action Team will keep track of the questions and we will get them answered at the end. So I'm very excited to introduce Veronica O. Davis. She's the Director of Transportation and Drainage Operations for Houston, Texas, leading the team responsible for maintaining and improving the infrastructure that spans Houston's 671 square miles. Veronica has nearly 20 years of experience in engineering and transportation planning. She is an entrepreneur and civil engineer, co-founding Inspire Green LLC, which manages community, multimodal transportation, and environmental planning and consulting. While at Inspire Green, she led the Vision Zero action plans for Washington, D.C. and the city of Alexandria. She's also co-founded Black Women Bike, an organization and movement which builds a community and interest in biking among Black women through education, advocacy, and recreation. Veronica was recognized as a champion of change by the White House in 2012 for her professional accomplishments and advocacy. Veronica graduated with a Bachelor of Science from the University of Maryland College Park and a Master of Engineering and a Master of Regional and Urban Planning, Land Use, and Environmental Planning from Cornell University. She completed graduate work towards a PhD in Civil Engineering from University of Maryland College Park. Veronica serves on committees for Transportation Research Board, the Board for America Walks, as well as technical advisory boards at the University of Maryland and Cornell University. So let's roll into our exciting conversation with Veronica O. Davis. First, my first question, Veronica, was if you could talk a little bit about how you came upon the title for the book as Inclusive Transportation, because in your book, you do talk a lot about equity, diversity, inclusion. And I got the sense that you felt that the word inclusive transportation was maybe more appropriate. And how did you decide on the title for the book?
Well, Angie, thank you for having me. Just one correction in my bio. So I'm actually at AtkinsRéalis. We're an engineering company. So I'm the director of cities, but I was the director of transportation and drainage up through January of last year. I did not survive the administration change, and those things happen. I also want to note I am solo parenting tonight. So hopefully, a little person stays in their room, but a little head might pop up. But that's life now, even in this digital age. How I came up with the title, as I was thinking about the book, we went back and forth through a whole bunch of things. And for me, really, it was about being inclusive. It's really about everybody. It's about having different ways to move. I love that the city of Nashville actually had a huge campaign in order to get funding for transportation, and they called it Choose How You Move. And at the end of the day, that's what this is about. As for me, it is people want to move in different ways, and every time someone leaves their home, they should have options. They might still choose to drive, but if they want to walk, they can do it safely. There is sidewalk infrastructure and curb cuts so that they can, move with anything with wheels. If people want to bike, they can bike and do that safely. If there's public transportation, that it's affordable, that it's accessible, it's reliable. And that's really what I was trying to get at. Mm-hmm. And then the subtitle, we went back and forth with the publisher, Island Press, of, well, is it a manifesto? Is it a handbook? Is it a, but I really like manifesto, right? Because it's really a declaration of this is how I think based on my life experiences and based on my professional experiences. And so this is just my manifesto. And I tried as I did the book to not make it so prescriptive that people felt like, okay, I got to do step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Mm-hmm. It was really to provide different frameworks that then someone can take in Iowa, can take the framework and make what works for them. Or someone in New York City can take the framework and make what works for them, because every community is so different. And so that's really why, how I came up with that. And then I will give a shout out to Martin Schmall, who did the art for the cover of the book. I think really just capturing transportation. And I love that there's no buildings. Right. Despite there's a little hint of a I Love New York on one of the vans, but there's no buildings. And so it is at the end, it's about transportation. It doesn't matter whether there's a house there or a skyscraper. Are we still moving people?
Yeah, I love that, moving people around. Yeah. One of my other questions, too, I don't know how comfortable, but like in your book, you talk a lot about redlining and capitalism and gentrification, and in the context really of transportation. And I think those are concepts that people are really familiar with in housing. But when you want to think about those concepts in transportation, especially in the context of healing and reparations, can you talk a little bit about those concepts in transportation and why you wanted to include those concepts in your book?
Absolutely. So I think a couple things, and I always remind people that when you look at history, you can't look at it with a today lens. And redlining is an example. Protective covenants are another example where I think sometimes we get caught in a black or white world. But I want to make sure it is very clear that there were people who were considered white for the purpose of a census, but were still affected by redlining and protective covenants, particularly Eastern Europeans, Polish, Hungarian, anyone that was of Jewish ethnicity. And I understand it's a religion too, but of that, Ashkenazi ancestry, Italians, Irish in some cases. And so and I say that because now people are trying to grapple with, well, who lost their homes? They're like, oh, white people lost their homes. Yes. And at that time, they were still restricted from living in certain communities. So that's just an important history note as we look back at these things. But what it did is what redlining, determined who could live where. You have the real estate industry that also had played their part. And there's a really interesting congressional hearing from, I think, the 1970s that talks about the role of the real estate industry in segregation and redlining, because they, ushered people to certain neighborhoods. Right. And so what that did is that it allowed that you could concentrate your investment in specific neighborhoods. And when you look today, right, in a 2025 lens, you'll see that typically rich neighborhoods have better amenities, right, have better walking infrastructure, have better roadways. Because once you segregate the people out, it makes it very easy to then focus your investment into very specific areas. And then you also have, with that white flight to the suburbs, plus our federal government funding many of people coming back from war, but mostly white people that were coming back from war, funding them to move further out into the suburbs, into these Levitt towns, and other places. So now you have to build highways to get people there and wider roads. And often that came at the destruction of people who couldn't leave the inner, the inner parts of the city for various reasons. And you see it all over this country. You see highways that were built that split neighborhoods in half. One of the things I share in my book is from East Baton Rouge, where my family's property was taken. in order to facilitate the construction of I-10, which connects Florida to California. And so you have all these things that have happened on top of it, plus, you know, you have the widened roads. So that's what we see today. So it all very is interconnected. And then for those that are listening in the housing space, what then happens is now with gentrification, right?
Yeah.
And that's a whole loaded term, but on the the bigger scheme of now that you have people with means moving back into urban areas, we're seeing housing prices go up and people being priced out of communities, and they're having to move further and further away. And so as they're moving further and further away for affordable housing, we're seeing now transportation costs going up, as well as transportation commute time and all of those other impacts. All of those are going up. So they're very much, housing and transportation are very interconnected, but our national policies don't allow us to look at them together.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Because also in your book, you were you had this analogy of the ER and triage, and how does a transportation planner prioritize equity when you only have so much economic ability to make an impact, prioritizing equity and neighborhoods? And like you did mention gentrification, and I know bike lanes, I think a lot about bike lanes. And are bike lanes seen by you as a form of gentrification? How do you?
You hit me with all the questions. Okay.
Sorry.
So yeah, no, it's okay. I'll take one at a time. So I think equity. So spoiler alert, I don't give a definition of equity because it's going to change depending on your community and depending on what you're looking at. How I get to equity is because equity is what everyone gets what they need, right? And I don't care. No one, we do not have the time, the people, or the money to actually meet the needs of every community. And that's whether you're talking about drinking water or transportation, or we just don't. So you have to prioritize. And if you focus in on safety, let's say, you know, it's the high injury network, and that's what we know from analysis of where people are dying and being seriously injured. We know every community has some type of that analysis. And if you look at that, then you can prioritize and say, we are going to prioritize safety around where we know people today are dying and being seriously injured. And yes, you person with political influence might have a condition that you feel is not safe or could be safer. I hear you. But right now we got people dying over here. And it's hard to balance that of like, let's have an actual framework for how we assess safety and how we prioritize safety. So there's that. And I talk a little bit about that in the book of what are you trying to get to? Because it's not about this beautiful definition of equity. It is, what does it look like for your community? And it might be a different vision. Your vision might be that no child anywhere in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, is ever struck or killed by a vehicle, right? Or your vision might be that a 10-year-old growing up in Sioux Falls is able to navigate independently from their house to school and to get some ice cream, right? Like, what is the vision that you are trying to achieve? And then that can help set your framework for metrics. And it was the other piece. What was the other one? It was a doozer.
Oh, I said our bike lanes kind of a sign of bike lanes. Is that how you do you?
They yes, yes, coming and
into a community, yeah.
Yes, and the reason why they're a sign for gentrification is the communities have been there, right? So, pick a community anywhere. That community has been there. That community has had needs, and no one has come to address their needs. That community maybe needed a bus stop. That community needed the buses to show up on time. That community may have been fighting for a stop sign since 1985, right?
Yeah.
And then you show up and say, hey, we're going to put in a bike lane. So it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but in a transportation context of you haven't met my basic need. I go to these community meetings, people are like, I was promised, and they will bring out year 1963. I asked the mayor for a stop sign and I've been fighting for one since. And you're coming with about a bike lane. So I think that's where it's a sign of gentrification of you clearly aren't coming to address my need. because you would have been here already.
Yeah.
So if you're not putting this in to address my need, then you're putting it in to address someone else's need. And that's how it gets wrapped up in gentrification. Do I think them bike lanes in of themselves are gentrification? No, but it's how we approach it. We've decided, the planners have decided, this is going to be a bike route. And this community is like, but you didn't talk to me about it. And I ride the bus and the bus isn't showing up on time. So I don't care about your bike lane. And that's what we dealt with. I share in the book an example of a bike project we had where, and again, so I was joking before we started the program of my next book is going to be, you should have listened to me the first time. But that was an example of a project when we started, you know, it's a bike lane project, but we have sidewalks in this corridor that aren't even meeting the basic, you know, Americans with Disability Act requirements. So you have a 3-foot sidewalk, you have tree roots, you have all these things. You have people who need to navigate by, you know, pushing a stroller or a grocery cart or a wheelchair, but I'm coming to talk about a bike lane. And then they're like, okay, but are you going to, nope, that's not part of this project. This is a bike project. So you've lost people before you even started the project.
Yep. Yeah, I really like too how you talk about people and getting that people can really influence a project, right? Like there's a group you talk about being the naysayers. If there's a group that really wants a certain project, that vocal group might really impact negatively a project. But also you talk a lot about the silently suffering group, and you've kind of alluded right to children and safety and our more vulnerable citizens, people who identify as having disabilities. And how do you get to hear their voice? You did talk about the example of meeting them where they're at, right? Like doing a survey at bus stops, but do you survey children? Like how do you hear from these vulnerable citizens?
Absolutely. So I think, so in the book, I talk about 4 groups. I talk about people in power, and those are your decision makers. It may be an elected decision maker, or during my time at the city of Houston, I was empowered to make a lot of decisions under my purview. And then there are the people that report to me that are also people in power. They may not feel like it, but they're the ones reporting to me the facts, the background, the data, and what they're deciding to do, and I'm blessing it or making them think about other things. Then in the middle, it's kind of the naysayers and the champions, and they don't like to be mixed in. But if you have a public meeting, that is who reliably is gonna show up. The passionate, the people that are just passionate for or against the project, and whether it's right or wrong, right? And then the silently suffering. And so to me, it is both children, it's people with disabilities, it is people who are, people just who can't drive for whatever reason, right? There's a lot of reasons why people can't drive or shouldn't be driving, but it's, you know, people that can't drive, or it's just not an option for them. But it's about going to where they are. And sometimes it's just working parents, right? Like people that are just trying to get through the next 24 hours and the next 24 hours after that. And it's not that your meeting and your little project is not important to them. They're just, of all the things I got to deal with, this is priority number 10, 10,000. Yeah. But it really is going where people are. So when you think about the different groups, children, absolutely you should engage children. The thing that's very interesting when you do, I know a lot of us may have done some type of a walk audit, and that's when you walk through your neighborhood and assess safety issues. It is so important to do that with children, and do it with a child that's around 8 to 10. And the reason why that is that they're shorter. And the thing that is so amazing is when you are an adult, your view is here, but children, and anyone who's ever walked with a toddler knows that children, they're at a different eye level. They see a whole bunch of things, they get distracted, but that's the level that you have to understand when you're talking about safety. Because a bush that I can comfortably see over at 5'3", if I'm 4 feet, that bush might be intimidating or might feel scary. So it's really important to engage youth in that way. When we did the Vision Zero plan for the District of Columbia, we had an entire session with 300 teenagers, right? And these are kids that can move independently throughout the city and have an experience. And specifically because of what we heard from the teenagers, we approached the enforcement section very differently. So prior to that, there was a lot of policies that had been put in there around enforcement. And one of the teenagers made a point that I hear you and I shouldn't jaywalk. And I understand that, but I'm assessing a different level of risk. If I walk straight, I might be walking into a group of guys that I don't know. If I'm going to visit my grandma or I'm visiting my friends, I'm walking right into a group of guys that I don't know. So now I'm putting myself in a different type of harm. And I would rather take my chance with the vehicle than I want to deal with these guys up the street. And that was their calculus. And then you realize, okay, let's actually look at the data. How are people dying? Where are they dying? And let's focus on that behavior. And so I absolutely think young people should be engaged. I did not work on the project, but one thing I will say, look up, it was in Detroit. They did an entirely child-centric long-range plan for a neighborhood. And everything was around kids. Mm-hmm. They had the youth involved all the way down to as young as kindergarten, involved in developing the future plan for their community and what it would look like for them to grow up in their community and eventually live in their community as an adult. So it's about going where people are. It's about engaging people where they are, getting captive audiences. You know, if there's a school near your project, go talk to the teacher, the principal, and ask if you can work with that school, do it part of a lesson plan in science or, you know, what have you. But it really is about the silently suffering being very intentional and going to work with them. And then the last group I do want to also talk about is the unhoused population. Homeless, unhoused, however you want to discuss it, it is people who are living on the street. And I think that that is a key demographic that we always leave out. So one, if they are living on the street, they are part of our transportation system.
Yeah.
Number two, many of them are moving because they are going to jobs. I think there's this misnomer, not all, but there's this misnomer that some people living on the street are just there, but there are some that actually get up and go to work and go to a job. And, you know, how are they, how's that movement being facilitated? Are they doing it safely? I will tell you, we were talking earlier about DC, Angie. There is a food kitchen in DC, right? It doesn't matter. It's in downtown. But if you go there in the evening, it's nothing but bicycles. And so that is how the homeless population are moving around, is by bike, because it's affordable. It's easy to maintain, and it gets them more to where they need to go.
Yeah. Yeah, your book on transportation is one of the few, I feel like, that really discuss at length this human element and how important it is to think about humans and how we move. And I love that you brought up Maslow's hierarchy too, because I'm a psychologist. And so I think a lot about humans and how do we shape human behavior. And I do bike for transportation. And I'm just curious if you know of ways that communities and or like employers could incentivize staff to consider other transportation options. We have a really big parking problem here in Iowa City. And I'm curious if you know of other communities that have, you know, figured out ways to incentivize staff, employees to think about other transportation options.
I think it's a couple things. So number one, let's take biking. So what does incentivize look like? You know, you think about most places. So if I drive to work, I don't drive to work, but if I were to drive to work, you know, and my employer gives me a parking space, let's say that's 150 a month. So if I bike to work, then what? Do I get that 150? So that's an incentive that I get paid. I know that some companies have done stipends, annual stipends for people to, you know, buy a bike or tune up their bike. But then once I get to work, so I bike to work, is there bike parking? Is it secure? Do I feel safe bike parking my bike? Is there a place to take a shower? Because maybe I get a little bit sweaty, right? Is there a place for me to shower? Is there a place for me to store my stuff? Is there a place that I can look presentable when I get to work? So all of those things are also part of the incentive. It's not enough to just say, you should bike and we're going to give you a gold star. Thank you for the gold star, but what does that have to do, right? Or even with public transit of, hey, you know what? If you take public transit, we'll subsidize it and you can start your workday on the transit. We see that your commute's about 30 minutes. So your work day starts as soon as you get on that bus, and you can work on the bus or check email or whatever. You know, all of those things are part of incentives. Or, hey, yeah, you know, you could be hybrid. You don't have to come in every day. You know, come in Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So I think when we think about incentives, it has to be holistic, because as long as I drive to my office and I have free parking, and unless you give something else, that is what the choice that people are going to continue to make.
Yeah. I mean, and it, for a lot of people here in our community, I think that parking is, it's just like, that's what we're used to, and so we just drive. But I do just want to give a shout out to our Iowa City community. We have a fare free bus system, so if you live in the Iowa City area, you could take the bus for free. But you did talk about reliable, it does come every 20-30 minutes or whatever, but having more frequent transportation might, you know, encourage some people. But I am just really proud that we live in a community that offers, right, fare free transportation.
But here's the thing from an incentive, right? So if my employer, even if it's $75 a month that they pay for my parking, if I take this free bus, do I get the 70, because you're going to pay for it. So do I get the $75 a month? Because that might be enough to incentivize somebody.
Yeah. I think too, our university recently, this past week, they're asking to build a $96 million parking ramp. And so you're paying how many thousands of dollars for my coworker to park their car? Like, could you give us all a few thousands of dollars for our bikes or whatever? Yeah, there's lots of ways to solve problems. So we just need to think creatively about all the different ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I do have a whole bunch of extra questions. A lot of questions I'm really excited about, but I do want to just go to the audience here and see if Megan has any questions in the chat that you'd like to ask about.
Nothing's popped up yet, but if anyone has any questions, please add them and we will get back to them.
Perfect. Great. Well, I'll ask one of my next questions too. You did, we've talked a little bit about the curriculum that you designed to encourage women to bike for transportation. I think in a lot of numbers and in our community, there is a gender difference between the number of women biking versus males who are biking. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your Black Women Bike curriculum and anything that you could share that others could learn from.
Absolutely. I think it's very easy to just say, oh, you should bike to work. But for a lot of people, if they haven't done it, they're just like, I don't know what to do. So with Black Women Bike, it was a couple things that we did. One was, there's the regional bike to work day within the DC region. But what we would do about 2 months before is actually teach people how to ride on the streets of DC. Because many of them could do a century. We had a lot of women and Black women bike who could bike a century and do all of these things. But mm-hmm. to put them on a roadway with cars, they just didn't know the rules. And so people felt more comfortable to actually say, okay, so we're going to do a turn. Here are the different ways you can make a left turn. You can go up in the middle of the road and try to make the left, or you can do a box turn. So it's just helping people mm-hmm. understand what they can do and how to do it safely. How to navigate different types of bike infrastructure, because, you know, for those of us in this transportation world, we put it in and assume people understand how to use it, but helping people understand that. We also had another session on how to bike at night, as I think mm-hmm. that we all recognize we're not as visible as we think they are, despite the fact, yes, people driving should pay attention, but how do you make yourself more visible at night? And even in the wintertime, as it gets cold, how do you protect yourself? How do you keep yourself warm, keep your limbs warm throughout the wintertime? So that was a lot of our curriculum. But then we also partnered with a couple other organizations so that people could even understand different bike options for commuting. And I understand there's a lot of privilege in that, but particularly for people that had to get kids to daycare or school, you know, helping them see the different types of cargo bikes to figure out what might work for that person, right? So I have a cargo bike with the e-assist, but my daughter goes on the back. Some people have the cargo bikes where, you know, the kid's in the front in a box, but you have to figure out what works for you. And so that was part of what we did. The other thing that we did was also teaching people how to do basic fixes on their bike. Because one of the things that we heard that people, that women very specifically were intimidated about was, what happens if I have an emergency and I need to get home, right? Because women, we always run through scenarios. So it's showing people how to fix their bike, showing people how to put their bike on the front of a bus, right? If that, if they need to, making sure that you always bike with your bus card because you can put your bike in front of the bus, but showing people how to do it because it can be intimidating. So it's just all of those things just to help people, you know, women feel more confident.
Yeah. I want to give a couple shout outs in our community. We have a practice of that, the bus rack, so that people can practice that. So that is across the street from City Hall here in the parking ramp. And also shout out to the bike library. Tuesday nights, they have a Women Trans Fem Night where women can go and learn how to do basic you know, mechanics on their bikes, and it's an environment for women to feel comfortable in that. So we do have some of these systems in our community that kind of already do exist. And it's interesting because you brought up the group of women who like could go and ride 100 miles, and so they clearly own a bike, but making that shift from recreation to transportation, we have a lot of recreation riders, and it is something I really think a lot about of how do we get that group to feel more comfortable using biking for transportation.
Yeah. And some of it may be, I remember this was years ago, in DC, we had a, bike to the brewery, breweries in DC. I don't necessarily remember recommend drinking while biking, but you know, but we had that. And so what it did was get people who may usually just go out and bike on trails to bike on the streets in a very fun group type of a setting. So that you have those type of things. Also, you have to accept some people just aren't going to bike to work. It is intimidating, right? Think about all the things that you have to think about. You're just trying to get to work. You're trying to get your child to school. You're trying to get this, trying to get that. Like for some people, it's a lot. But biking to the grocery store might be more manageable because the grocery store is only a mile away and I'm not under a time crunch. I'm not, you know, I don't have anywhere to be. And that might be more attainable for people. Or biking to the library. Oh, my kids got to go pick up the library, or I want to go pick up a library book. That might feel more attainable. Or, you know, biking, think about all the trips that we make in a week. There may be other trips that are more attainable, especially since for most errands, people don't go more than 2 miles from their house anyway. So it's like, can we start helping people think about converting some of those trips to a bike ride?
Yeah, that's right. Having small goals that they actually can achieve. That's a good way to think about that. Look, meeting those small goals. Earlier, you were talking about, oh, sorry, do you have a question?
No, it's totally fine. I was going to say we have questions now, Angie, if you want to pause yours. Attendees. So I'll just go in order of received. I was curious if you have heard of the recent memo which directs the DOT to prioritize federal funding for communities with higher marriage and birth rates. What does such a policy mean for transportation equity?
So I think from a policy perspective, it's one of those of people who write a policy without actually looking at the data. I will say that I know I've definitely heard about it, and there have been maps that are going around where there's a map of birth rates, there's a map of marriage rates, but where they're both high, the concentric circles, it's not really a whole lot of communities that have both high marriage rates and high birth rates. So I think it's one of these policies that it feels good to say, but I think in practically it, I don't even know what it means. The data is just not even there to support. That's like, what, so is all federal money going to go to like two counties in the US? Like, so I think there's that part of it.
Cause I mean, I guess I'm wondering if the question is alluding to like, will we use data then to fund certain areas more than we fund others?
Okay, so we use it all the time. I mean, the quiet part out loud is when it comes to grant funding, you know, there is the putting in a good grant application, meeting the criteria, whatever that might be. And then there is, you know, the people on the Hill, right? They write their support letters, but behind the scenes, they're making phone calls, you know, advocating for their, for the project in their particular district. So what happens, again, I don't know, just given those two, they just don't overlap. But I think that there's opportunity in that, right? You got to just deal with the cards that are dealt to you of, you know, high birth rates. Okay, well, fine, we'll focus on kids, right? Like, we can focus on schools and things like that. But I don't know. I don't think in practice it's going to yield what I think the intent of what is trying to be achieved.
Thank you, Veronica. We do have a few more in chat. So next, this person is thanking you, saying it's been enlightening. Are there certain U.S. cities or communities that you think are leading on inclusive transportation front? What pilots are they trailing? And what do you think those places have? Why do you think those places have been successful? Sorry.
Okay. That's all right. I'm always going to start with Minneapolis, Minnesota, right? That is my sleeper pick for all the cities. I know that people like to look to New York and DC, Seattle, Austin. Minneapolis is my sleeper city. And partly in that, they are attempting to transform themselves into something different. But they're probably the first city to truly tackle the housing and transportation side by side. They're one of the first to outright ban single family homes, you know, big lots, in order to get more density and the ability for more different housing types on a property, so that things can be more affordable to different types of people that might live in their community. They have been investing in public transportation. I always judge a city by, can I get from the airport to their downtown seamlessly without even understanding? And theirs is very seamless, very easy to understand, for how to even get a fare card or, you know, whatever, and to be able to get on and get to where you need to go. And their investment in that public transportation. I think Minneapolis is consistent. I think they might still be the number one biking city. Y'all can fact check me. But they've been consistently in the top five, even though it's Minneapolis. And that's, again, partly of their investment in bicycle infrastructure. And I'm going to also give them a shout out for the fact that they've been investing in the arts, and the fact that there is public art that they're not just putting in a bus stop. They're putting in a beautiful bus stop that displays public arts and all of that. So Minneapolis is going to always be my sleeper pick city. Check them out. Some other cities, I say to look at Kansas City is another one. They're installing in their light rail system now. They've been investing in bicycle infrastructure throughout the city and trying to make things safer for everyone. So that's another city that's trying to do things in a way that meets the goals of equity and what it looks like for them. Let me see, who else would I say? And then I'll say keep an eye on Nashville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited. So for those, I mentioned it earlier, but they passed a $3.1 billion referendum called Choose How You Move. I think it's kudos to the current mayor, Freddie O'Connell, and his vision for investing in transportation. But it'll be very exciting to see how this gets implemented. I know that equity is part of their framework of how they want to invest and ensure that anyone in Nashville is able to navigate and get around. They have a housing pricing problem and a housing affordability challenge, but I think it will be interesting to see what they look like in the next couple of years. So those are three off my head.
That's great.
All right, next one. In a city that's planned in a car-centric way, like having all grocery stores in town on a highway, like this person's hometown, how can we as regular people go about starting to diversify transportation methods?
So as regular people, so number one, there is somebody that you elected to represent you. I'm always gonna start there. There is somebody that you went in a voting booth, assuming you voted, but there's somebody that you voted for to represent you. So I think start there. Reach out to your transportation department. have them come out and visit and say, hey, this is where I live. This is what I would like to see. What is planned for this community? Going online, seeing what's planned, because sometimes there might have been a plan for 15 years ago and, you know, then it just went stale. And, you know, so starting there. And then, you know, depending on the level of involvement you want, you may have to join a board and commission in order to fight for some of these things. So I say there's that, getting involved in your community, so that you can just understand the different transportation projects that happen. So that's, to me, is like what a regular citizen can do, but always start with your elected officials.
Uh-huh. Great. Thank you. Under the current administration and its hostility towards alternative transportation, how should cities adjust to ensure they keep making progress towards inclusive transportation?
So how can cities adjust? So I think, so it's a few things, right? When it comes to cities, the only thing that the feds can impact is funding, right? So I think for cities, there may have to be a case of locally funding some projects, maybe shifting some priorities in order to locally fund projects. But before we even get there, I'm still going to go back to, you need to talk, you sent someone to go represent you in Capitol Hill, and you need to start with them. You need to call their office. You need to write their office. You need to email this office. I know that things can feel chaotic right now, and this is regardless of what party or whatever your beliefs, things might feel chaotic. You might love everything that's happening, but at the end of the day, we are still we the people of the United States of America. And it is important, however you might feel, that you continue to raise your voice, because we could be frustrated on this Zoom call and that's it. Or we can email our senators. You have two people that represent you in the Senate. You have a person that represents you in the House. Are you contacting them? Because I know I am. Even for me, you know, I'm very concerned about the future of the National Environmental Policy Act. And so I emailed my senator. I emailed both my senators and my representative. And if they look at it, I don't know, but I'm going to keep emailing them. And if I have to, I will show up at Capitol Hill and I will go knock on their door. So I think that for all of us, we can't, regardless of what the administration may view, at the end of the day, Congress is the one that works on the bipartisan infrastructure law and any type of bipartisan bill. Congress is the one that sets the funding. And so we have to keep our congressional representatives and hold them to account.
All right. We have two more at this moment in time. Veronica, I'm curious if you have a success story from a small city that was able to reduce their vehicles' miles traveled. So many model cities are very large ones that can create much more robust transit network than a small city like Iowa City.
I actually will say, look to Ithaca, New York. That's where I went to grad school. Ithaca, New York is, I don't know, maybe 40,000 residents or so. Mm-hmm. But even with it being it's kind of a rural city, but it is by definition a city, really good public transportation network. And in infrastructure. So that's one that I would look at, where you could actually live in Ithaca, New York, in the middle of nowhere, and actually be able to move around by bus. And I think that a lot of it is because it is a college town. And I think a lot of those examples are going to be college towns. But you do have the two universities, Cornell and Ithaca College, that are also investing in that public transit that is operating, 24/7. So that's what I can think of offhand from a small city. And it all depends on how small you want to go. But that's one I can think of. I don't know if Salt Lake counts as small. Salt Lake, surprisingly, is very easy to navigate without a car, surprisingly. I'm trying to think what else offhand. Oh, most recently, I was in West Palm Beach. Although I feel like it doesn't count because they are very, they are on the wealthier side of things. But I was pleasantly surprised around the walkability of West Palm Beach. You do have transit, and then you have the Bright Line that connects to Fort Lauderdale and Miami, mm-hmm. which I love the Bright Line, by the way. I feel mm-hmm. like Florida needs to talk about that more. I think it was a great experience, and I love Amtrak, but that Bright Line was a great experience. That's what I can think of offhand. I don't know if Angie yeah. or Megan, you have any that you can think of.
Those are good.
All right, our last question in chat for the moment. Are there specific issues that rural communities face when it comes to accessing equitable transportation? How are these being addressed?
Absolutely. So, and I want to be very clear about rural, because sometimes you can get these suburban areas that cosplay rural, and they're not rural. They just don't have sidewalks, but that doesn't make you rural. I think the biggest challenge when it comes to rural, particularly that kind of isolated, true rural communities, it's you have an aging rural population. Many of their kids have moved away. And so now you have older generations living in these rural communities with no access. I do know that there have been some, there is in Northern California, they have a rural community where they actually have on-demand transit that services some of those rural areas. In the Baltimore region where I live now, there is some type of on-demand transit, but I think that's where you really get into equity issues. And I'm gonna tie this also back to kind of conversations that happen federally. The other piece is the big risk of the United States Postal Service, right? I think for many rural communities, that last mile for whether it's FedEx, UPS, they actually use USPS, the US Postal Service, for that last mile delivery. And when I think about, I have an aunt and uncle who live in very much a rural community, and I'm talking rural, like you pull up on the beginning of their road, just turn your cell phone off because there's no signal. Nothing is getting through. The Wi-Fi is gonna be hit or miss. And so they do rely on, now that they're getting older, they rely on Amazon and other delivery services, whether it's for food or for packages. And so that U.S. Postal Service becomes a critical lifeline for many of our rural communities. So as we think about equity and we start making these policy decisions, if the U.S. Postal Service changes its functions, it's really going to impact the rural communities. I think the other piece too is around children getting to school. I know that in some states, there's these debates, you know, when I left Texas, the debate around school choice and vouchers, but for many rural communities, those public schools are the lifeline for that community. That is usually the only school available, and the teachers live in that community, and that school is a hub of social cohesion for that particular rural community. And so then even once you start investing in, school choice, it starts to take money away from that public schools. And usually the first thing impacted is public transportation. And so you already have these kids that are getting up at O'Dark 100 because of the route, right? It's a rural route. It's taken an hour just to go 5 miles just because you got to go up each little pass. So those are really the equity issues that we see, that you see around rural areas, and I'm sure there are more. On the safety side with rural, that is where we tend to see higher DUI type crashes is going to be in those rural back roads. And, you know, they're twisty roads and they're hard to do without having a drink. So, you know, you have a little brewski or two, and those roads get a little bit harder to drive. And you also throw in, you know, you got deer. You know, running across, I hit a deer driving through, you know, the rural parts of New York when I lived, when I was going to school in upstate New York, you know, hunting season, you got deer flying over the place, you hit a deer, you're in a ditch. So those are some of the challenges. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's more that I can't think of, but those are the ones that are top of mind.
Another question came in. What are you seeing are things cities can learn, even smaller cities, from the big 28x2028 games push from LA to make all transit to and from Olympics car free?
I think what we can all learn is it's just having that level of focus. One European example is Freiburg, Germany. And right now, I think their mode share, something like 80% is by public transit, biking and walking. And even as we think about the Netherlands, I know they get, you know, a lot of love for biking, but they actually have a really great public transit system that's easy to use. And even at, you know, 11:30 on a Tuesday, they're operating at 5-minute headways. But I think when you have something like that to focus on, you see the focus and the investment in public transportation. We're in this place where we try to piecemeal it, where we put in a bus line and we're like, oh, no one's using the bus. Okay, but I still can't get to the bus stop. Or where is the bus stop? Okay, I get to the bus stop. Is there a place to sit? Is there a place to that I could easily understand when the bus is coming? And so then we say, oh, no one's using the bus. Well, we should abandon this. So I think that when you look at, you know, LA, it's truly the investment in public transportation. I brought up Salt Lake, but part of that was around the Winter Olympics, whenever that was, back in the early aughts, maybe. But Salt Lake making that investment in public transportation and being hyper-focused and everyone understanding hyper-focus, that now this community can benefit from the fact that there's still a light rail and that there's still heavy rail to get from the suburbs into downtown. So I think that that's the biggest thing that cities can take away. As far as free transit, very controversial statement. I'm not really for free transit. I think that there are benefits to it, but there was a study done by Transportation Research Board a few years ago, and they actually surveyed low-income people, because this is where it's, if we're going to make it free, who are we trying to serve? What tends to happen when you make these things free is that the choice riders now choose to do it. And we saw this with DC Circulator, where because Circulator was a dollar, higher income people were riding it because they're like, oh, it's only a dollar, I'll ride it. But when we asked them, hey, would you pay $2 for it? They were like, no, I really don't want to ride it like that. I just ride it because it's a dollar. When we went in the low income neighborhoods and we said, well, what if we increased the price to $2? They were like, oh, absolutely. And partly it was because we were providing a dependable bus service. They knew that I don't have to really look at the schedule because I know there's a bus coming every 10 minutes. So to me, and there was this, so back to this TRB study. So this TRB study found that for low income people, the biggest way to have a positive impact on their life is to reduce the, to improve the frequency between buses. That is the biggest way to have, that is a bigger improvement on people's lives than making it free or reducing the fares. And so not that I'm against free transit, I think it's a nice thing, but I feel like if we're gonna make the investment in money, it is a better investment of our money in order to add more bus service so that you can get to a, you know, 5 to 8 minute headway between buses that is reliable for people. I think that's just a better use of funding and to have just a better bus network overall. So that people can get to where they're going.
Yeah, that does make sense. We're in our community, we're also talking about like a metro, but even the metro wasn't gonna, you know, it was like every 45 minutes. And so having something reliable that just, you don't even have to look at the schedule does make a lot of sense in regards to equity. Yeah.
I live in Baltimore now and I have a bus route. I have no idea what the schedule is. I just know I go out there. Yeah. And when I go sit down, the longest I'm going to sit is 10 minutes. And it depends on the time of day. Sometimes those buses are coming every 5 minutes. Sometimes it might be, you know, 10 minutes exactly. But I know that as I go sit out there, the longest I'm going to sit is 10 minutes. So I'm willing to do it because I don't want to pay for parking when I get downtown and I don't like driving in traffic.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. One of the things that we've kind of been mentioned a little bit, just in the beginning, you were talking about mobility and letting everybody, you know, move. We are a college town and we have a parking issue. And I've seen a rise in the number of e-scooters. And we don't really have a great place for e-scooters. Like, do they belong on sidewalks? They don't really belong on roads. You know, do we make mobility lanes just to help with e-scooters or anything? So I was curious if you've had any experience with communities now with the rise in e-scooters, what do we do with all of them?
I think anything that reduces the number of people driving is a great thing. And I think with e-scooters, what some communities have done, it's going back and reevaluating their bike infrastructure, and they'll call them, you know, micro mobility lanes, because now you have e-bikes, which are giving people the ability to go further distances, you know, whether they use the e-bike or not, or the e-assist or not. It's just the fact that they can. And there's a lot of studies, even with older adults, they're more willingness to bike because they know if they need it, I have this little assist in case I get a little bit tired. And so I think it's causing the entire industry to rethink bike infrastructure and in a way that can facilitate e-scooters, e-bikes, and other ways that people are moving on smaller, you know, things in a space. And so I think they absolutely should be in protected bike lanes. And when I say protected, I'm being very clear, concrete protected, because I don't think anything else works, because people can't drive and people are crazy and people are rude. So I think it needs to be concrete protected. So I think there's that. Because I do think there is a care to have of not having people on scooters with people walking, just because people walking are unpredictable. That is the most unpredictable group moving through a system, right? Because at least bikes are kind of predictable. They're going forward or back, right? But people walking, they're on their phones, they're stopping. Oh, my shoe's untied. Introduce a child and who knows what's going to happen. I think that movement is so chaotic that you just need to leave people to themselves and move all of those modes in a protected manner. And then from a parking perspective, is making sure that there is a place that people can park their e-scooters such that it's not in the sidewalk, in people's, you know, path of walking or, you know, rolling or what have you.
Yeah. Well, I was just noticing the time. It looks like I'll just end with one last question. Our city is working on updating our comprehensive plan. So, right, that happens about every decade. Do you have any advice for our city as we're preparing to update our comprehensive plan?
Absolutely. I will say this. I think, so in chapter 6, I talk about setting a bold vision. I think a lot of times when we do these planning efforts, we're so focused on what we see today. And we try to extrapolate from today, right? So we say, this is what it is today. So from today, this is what I want to get to. I think when you're talking about a long-range comprehensive plan, what is the city that you want to be? And that has to be the focus. Because I think that as long as you're only focused on what you see today, I think you're going to limit the possibilities. And so as you think about the future, what is truly possible? What is the truly the type of city that you want? And make a vision, right? And it could be that, you know, we want a city that a child can thrive no matter what the zip code is, that that child has access to green space, that they can get to a place where they can read books, that they can walk to quality schools, whatever it is, but have a true vision for what it is you want and then work back from there. Because none of us know the future, right? None of us knew 20 years ago that we could be on this computer looking at each other with you in Iowa and I'm in the state of Maryland, right? Like we would have never known that. So I think you have to kind of let go a little bit of what is possible. I think as you're doing the comp plan, engage the youth. They don't have the scripting that we have as adults, right? Yeah. If you go talk to an 8-year-old, everything is possible to them. Even talk to a teenager, everything is possible. So I think getting the young people involved and active and engaged on what do they see as the future for their city, right? So that they don't just go to college and never come back. What is the place that they want to come back to? What are the things that they want to achieve? So I think that's going to be key. I think the other advice for any of the advocates on here is how are you as an advocate taking this to your neighbors? And it might be that sometimes we have to get out of our own echo chamber. Right? If we all have our group that we love to talk with, but can you hold a, you know, living room session with a few of your neighbors and explain what a comp plan is, right? There's a lot of people, they're just going to work and they're coming home. They don't even know this thing is happening. So how are you talking to your neighbors about what is a comp plan? Why should they care? Why should they be involved? How can they lend their voice? Hey, here's a link to the survey. So I think there's that piece of it too.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thanks so much. I've had such a great time with this conversation. We all really appreciate you taking the time out of your really, really busy schedule to talk to us here in Iowa about all the exciting transportation things that are happening. So thank you so much. And thank you so much to all of our attendees. I know that I continue to want to have the conversations like this. And so I have a few more ideas on some things that I want to do in our community to continue to have this conversation. So thank you, everyone.